Welcome to the Claim Hunters. I am Chris Tidball, an executive claim consultant with Subro IQ, where we routinely find our clients significant amounts of trapped cash. On our show, we will explore the epidemic of trapped cash across not only the insurance industry, but the global business landscape. Our guests bring a unique perspective on challenges faced by businesses that impact their bottom line. We believe that everyone has a great story to tell, and this is the forum to tell it. We hope you enjoyed today's episode and stick around to learn more about how you can be a guest in 20 minutes or less.
Hello, everybody. This is Ashton Kirsch, your host with today's episode of a very unique podcast episode, because this is not just the Subrogation Support Network today. This is the Subrogation Support Network teamed up with my good friend, Chris Tidball, who has the Claims Hunter podcast. We're going to do a joint podcast episode today. Make it interesting. There's not that many Subro podcasts out there. So I think it's important that you in the industry know about both of us so that you can get some good claims education and give you something fun to do on your way to work. So Chris, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thank you very much for having me. And I think we probably are the only two Subro podcasts out there.
For a while, I was telling everybody that I am the premier and largest Subro podcast in the world because I had thought I was the only Subro podcast. And then you and I were talking for a while, and I remembered, I think Gary Wickert came on one of your podcasts. I'm like, you know what? Chris has actually a really well-regarded podcast. We got to get together on this and make sure our audience knows about both of us going out there.
Yeah, I think it makes sense. We do a lot of work together, so we definitely should join forces. And I think we probably bring some different perspectives, obviously, with you being an attorney with a well-respected subrogation law firm. And then I'm with Subro IQ, which is, I guess, probably the largest non-carrier subrogation outfit in the country. We see a lot of things that are going on in the industry.
Absolutely. So I think to start, let's both tell each other a bit about our podcast for the sake of the audience, for those who don't listen to yours and listen to mine and vice versa. Tell me a bit about yourself, Chris, and tell me a bit about the podcast and kind of the background on why you decided to get this thing going.
Yeah, absolutely. So my background is long, so I won't go into everything, but I started out as an adjuster many years ago, kind of worked my way up through the ranks of a couple of carriers, large carriers, one domestic, one global. And after 2008 and the economic collapse that happened, I ended up on this side of the industry providing services back to insurers. And it's been mainly subrogation focused. It's an area that carriers seem to really struggle with. We really focused initially on just going out and finding missed subrogation, and that's kind of morphed into something bigger because now we cover all facets of subrogation, both here in the States and abroad. And the podcast really spun up from people want to hear what's going on. What are the trends? What are you seeing? And rather than making 100 phone calls, I can bring 100 people together on a podcast and we can share everything that's new and interesting that's out there.
Absolutely. And so how long has your podcast been going on? Because I know it's been quite a while since I remember Gary Wickert jumped on.
Yeah, I want to say Gary was on probably about 2 years ago. And we started this about 2 years ago. What we try to do is focus on people that have a good message to share. And oftentimes it's subrogation related, but it's not always subrogation related. We'll get people in there that I just had a guest, one of our partner companies, Brown & Joseph, they focus on premium collection. And we've got another partner company, Paragon Deductible or Paragon Asset Recovery Services, but they focus on commercial deductibles. Really, the theme is there's a lot of money out there. And I tell people it's billions and billions of dollars that are missed. In fact, I remember Gary telling me that four of his five largest recoveries ever, they were all seven figures. Four of them were subrogation opportunities that were missed by the adjuster. And that's a lot of money. And so when we say billions and billions of dollars in missed recoveries, I mean, we're probably being pretty conservative on that front.
And that's huge, right? When I do training, and one of my most impactful trainings that I give to all of our clients is actually not a training for the subroute team, Chris, but it's a training for the frontline adjusters, those people who are initially reviewing the claim and flagging subrogation. And in those trainings, we talk, hey, you need to know enough to be dangerous, right? To red flag it. It's not about saying, hey, here's when we assess liability. No, we don't want them to assess liability. We want them to give a red flag so several can review and also work with good vendors who can do the same thing with technology and be it outsourced opportunities. Because yeah, you're right. We see it all the time. I have just a few weeks ago, I had a case, worked up a fantastic argument against the Department of Transportation on it was the lip on the side of a road, was about 8 inches. It was an awful situation. But in this state, our claim was limited to $500,000 against the government entity. We had a big catastrophic injury and one death. In the end, I had a plaintiff's attorney reach out and we worked together. And we actually came up with a crashworthiness argument and settled for a 7-figure settlement. These things get crazy. And it's about seeing those missed opportunities because subrogation doesn't always come up wrapped in a gift box with a bow on it, right? You got to get down in the dirt. You got to dig through the sand. You got to overturn every stone and find these things. Same as we recovered on a few years ago, earthquake claim, right? Earthquakes are occurring in Oklahoma. We're able to prove with seismologists and experts that earthquakes were being caused by fracking. Big 7-figure recovery there. So Gary was right when he said, we recover, at least our firm, and definitely you guys being on the front line of this, recover a lot of money on cases that just weren't identified in the first place.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it's funny that you do training as well. One of the things that I do for clients when they ask is get in there and sit down with the frontline adjusters and talk about basic stuff, just the basic concepts of liability, the basic tenets of comparative negligence. And you walk them through a couple hour seminar on doing a better job, and you generate more business that way. And one of the things that I do is I give people, I take a real case, fictionalize the names, and it involves a pedestrian hit, but there's multiple parties involved in this. And I'm like, everyone tell me right now, who's at fault and what percentage they're at fault? And you'll get stuff that, you know, kind of all over the board. Usually, I guess there's never a right or wrong answer, but it's, you listen to their logic at the beginning of the seminar, and then you have them go back at the end and explain what they were thinking and what they think now. And it's amazing how close, you know, they actually become once you calibrate them. What really stuns me is we see a tremendous amount of claims where it's assessed at 0 or 100%. There's no comp neg even thought of. Yet when you go and you look at jury verdicts, juries almost always apportion liability. And so you're taking 12 people or 6 people, depending on the venue, that really don't even understand liability, yet they're coming up with the right outcome. So why is it that paid professionals that are trained on this are often missing so much of it?
And I think that comes, it has a lot to do with training, right? Which I think that our companies both do a really good job, and these podcasts do a great job of going out to the audience. And that was the goal of, I created this podcast, Subrogation Support Network, because we had a LinkedIn page and I created the Subrogation Support Network on LinkedIn. And out of nowhere, we ended up having about 1,000 people just join and asking questions, really talking to each other and getting into some really complex and unique dialogues. And I thought in my mind, we do training seminars, but hey, we need something out there readily accessible. Because there's a lot of people who aren't, of course, those who are subrogation professionals, attorneys, adjusters. This is huge for them. But there's a lot of people that listen to these podcasts who are just trying to learn a little bit more. They might be frontline adjusters, liability adjusters. They might be coverage attorneys. But a lot of people that just want to know a little bit more about subrogation and subrogation practices. And that's a lot about why we created this. Because you're totally right. A lot of this gets to this. It's an art and a science in a way. For example, you mentioned obviously juries can go any way, right? There's going to be some fault allocated different directions. But we have situations where a lot of times, I'm sure you deal with this on your end, for clients, they've been doing this for years. They don't even know how comparative fault, contributory negligence rules apply and how Maryland may be different from Louisiana. And in Louisiana, hey, guess what? We could have somebody who is 80% at fault. Our insured could be 80% responsible. But guess what? We have subrogation for that other 20% against the defendant. It's really those unique intricacies that I think you and I both serve this role to help the industry kind of get better at that. And nobody's going to be an expert, right? My firm litigates subrogation cases in all 50 states, Mexico, Canada, most of Europe, several Asian countries. It's something we do across the board. But even our attorneys, who are really good at it, we write the book on it. But we still don't know the intricacies of every single law for every single attorney. But it's about knowing where to find it. It's about being able to do issue spotting, know enough to be dangerous so we can find out, know what we don't know, and then evaluate from there.
Yeah, it's really whether you're an attorney, whether you're an adjuster, you find that the common theme among the most successful are that they have this insatiable curiosity, that they want to go and they want to dig up everything. And unfortunately, these days, I can't speak for lawyers, but adjusters are busy. My son's an adjuster, and he tells me the number of claims that he gets, and there's just not enough hours in the day. And I think back to, I started as an adjuster many years ago, and we did everything. We did our own subrogation. We did our own salvage. We wrote our own estimates. We met with attorneys. We did clinic inspections. We did everything. But we were not getting 10, 12 claims a day. We were getting a couple claims a day and pounding the pavement. Back then, before laws came into place that really limited the number of hours that adjusters can work in a lot of jurisdictions, you're working 10, 12, 14 hours a day just to uncover what you can, because you really, it's like a mystery. You want to get to the bottom of what really happened, where now it seems like it's just become a lot of processing. So here's your claims, get your disposition rate to 100% and just move these files. And that can be done, but it's a huge disservice to everybody involved because you're leaving a lot of money on the table.
Every case is different. And that's what I always tell clients. There's no cookie cutter way to handle subrogation.
Right.
Our firm does a ton of work comp subro. And in that space, we talk to adjusters all the time. And they're saying, yeah, work comp. That's where you take a third. That's it. That's work comp subrogation. You send a bunch of letters and that's it. It's hold up. Absolutely not. We need to be active. In many states, you can get 100% if you intervene, you take action. So a third doesn't work. But that's a symptom of kind of the overworked and overstressed nature of the system, which is why insurance carriers, you might see the same thing, but the carriers don't really talk to each other. There's some industry groups, but they do an awful job of doing. There's some anti-monopoly laws, certain things that keep them from having certain communications, but they should be talking about, hey, what's the right number of claims for a workers' compensation subrogation adjuster to handle? How should this work? Because I can tell you across the board, some of our best clients have very experienced adjusters and they're handling 200 maybe cases each on their plate. Then I talked to other carriers, big carriers. And so why aren't we getting great recoveries on a case-by-case basis? Then you look deeper and you realize, yeah, that adjuster has 700 files. So that's not going to work. You're not going to be able to do that efficiently and effectively. So that's one thing I think that like having dialogues like this, it gets this into the mindset and into the attention of the industry in a way. And I think it's a great, really way to keep those things moving forward to make sure that there is a commonality, a common basis for these carriers to figure out what are the best practices, what's working, what isn't working. And I think one of those huge things is how do we identify claims? Now, one thing I wanted to ask you about, Chris, is you have just a fascinating background in helping develop certain processes, procedures for identifying subrogation opportunities that nobody knew existed. Yeah, we recovered some of the huge figures on some of these claims, but we partner with companies like you've had to figure out where, how do you find those things? And I think there's a big problem right now in the industry. One, those claims aren't being identified, but two, I think a lot of carriers are relying far too much on technology alone and or far too much on the human dynamic alone. When you need to have really a use being using AI, using algorithms, using processing to identify those claims, that's a tool that must be used. But that doesn't do away with the person actually looking at those files and handling those claims. Where does that dividing line come into place? I'd love to get your thoughts, you know, how carriers should be implementing both technology and human elements to identify missed opportunities.
Yeah, that's a good point. It really is. In this day and age, it is the combination of people, processes, and technology. I think a lot of people are looking to AI can do everything. AI can't do everything. And probably for the rest of our lives, AI won't be able to do everything in the world of claims. Because to your point, every single claim is different. And you have to have well-trained people that understand this. And it's not, I think what happened along the line was Back when I started as an adjuster, most carriers had multi-line generalist adjusters that would go out and they understood different coverages, different coverage types. They understood all facets of liability and damages. And from the outset of the claim, they were working that thing from cradle to grave. What happened over the years, in the name of probably getting some efficiencies, and I think there is something to be said for this, is you create these specialists. So somebody handles the liability, somebody handles the damages, somebody handles the subro, the salvage, et cetera. And if you talk to consumers, they're not really thrilled about having to talk to 8 different people on their claim. But that's not the primary concern. Their primary concern is we've got to maintain our combined. We've got to be profitable. And all of that's hugely important. But I don't think that it has to be all or nothing. I think that when you put together the right people with the most efficient processes in place, and I'm a Six Sigma black belt, and I've spent a number of years digging into looking for process defects, and they always exist. There is no such thing as a perfect process. You could come close, right? So flying an airplane, for example, you want to be as close to perfect as possible because outcomes are bad if you're not. But in the world of corporate America, they say that a Six Sigma is basically 4 defects per million opportunities. They say that in our world, we operate at about a 3 Sigma, which means you have about 300,000 defects per million opportunities. Not all the defects are fatal. It could be as simple as your goal is to return a phone call within 2 hours and it took you 3 hours. That is a defect. But there's also the leakage aspect. So you have the wrong people, you have ineffective processes, and maybe you are becoming over-reliant on technology. And technology is hugely important, but without the people and the processes, it's garbage in, garbage out. And I'll give you an example. I, back in the day, had sold some software that was focused on helping adjusters identify comparative negligence. When it was used properly, you could take a carrier from an average of 3% of claims were identified before the tool was implemented to 15% after it was implemented. But when it was not properly applied with the right people and the right processes, your 3% stayed 3%. And the same goes across the board for subro, salvage, whatever. So what I tell people when we sit down to onboard somebody is, let's understand what you're doing, right? I want to know what you're doing starting at first notice of loss. What are your frontline adjusters doing? What happens throughout the process? And then how do things get missed? And that's really the purpose of the closed file audits that we do is, let's go in. We're a bunch of claims folks. We spend a lot of time on that side of the industry. We have seen this before. If this is the point in the process where the defect occurs, let's fix this. And that way we improve your process and then we get the files over. The technology piece is hugely important. Look, we use technology to identify subrogation right out of the gate. You build your models, but models aren't perfect. You have to keep training models. So you, at the outset, you know, what sets us apart, I think, from what a lot of vendors do that say, hey, we're an AI solution. That's great. After stuff runs through our AI, we pend it off to a group of trained adjusters that will go back and they'll look for things that the AI missed. And you'll find things, a tremendous number of false positives. And that way you can provide that feedback loop to make the AI better. 20 years from now, that AI may be perfect. Right now, you got to have your people and processes.
And we have companies out there, vendors. I've seen them, right? I've competed against them. Where I go to a big motor carrier, that's one of my big lines of business, and I'm talking to them. They say, hey, when cases move to litigation, you need to make sure you have good counsel. We can't just use some debt collector to handle your insured subrogation. And then I start talking to them, and we talk about their processes. And then we find out, oh, yeah, we have this claims vendor. They're a subro vendor, and they handle our work at, no joke, Chris, I had one that said at 1%, 1% contingency fee. I was like, I can't compete. Not going to happen. But then I'm like, can you tell me more? Oh, yeah, they brought in $3 million this year for us. $3 million. So happy. We're so happy. So if you can match them, we'll give you a chance. I'm like, yeah, I can't match you. But tell me more. And they don't want to tell more. But then we start looking, it's like, what's your total exposure? And it was like near $500 million. I'm like, okay, what industry are you in? We look at averages and we realize, yeah, they brought in 3 million. They should have brought in nearly 100 million. And right. You look at that, it's hard to judge and assess when it comes to those things. So I dug deeper into that situation and found out, oh, why they're charging 1%? Because they have no employees in the United States. They send out template demand letters. I looked at some of the letters. They weren't even written correctly. They had mistakes. They had this or that. Many of them were asking for less than the total demand amount, but they weren't even asking for loss of use, definitely not diminution in value. And there were so many missed opportunities. But that carrier, that self-insured in this scenario, they looked at it and said, oh, 1% versus 1/3. Wow, we're going with that. And then you find out that you're stepping over dollars to pick up dimes, and it just doesn't work. Now, that's one end of it. And those companies, they're out there selling, saying, hey, AI, be all, end all solution. You don't need claims people. We use technology. And you find out we're nowhere near that. AI is amazing. I've done a few podcast episodes. I'm speaking in NASP on autonomous technology. This is something I'm passionate about. But it surely, we're nowhere near the point where it's taken over for the human dynamic. It makes our lives easier. I use AI processing and software for a lot of my day-to-day tasks. Piece of advice, don't use open source or ChatGPT for any confidential information. Too many lawyers and adjusters are doing that. That's a big no-no. But if you have a proprietary system or if you use something without inputting actual claims data, it can be hugely impactful. But it still doesn't change the need for that person. So it's almost like we found a tool and that tool is amazing. But the problem is the hammer doesn't strike itself. You still need that person. And what happens here is when these vendors, other companies are selling just the AI solution as the everything, guess what it's doing? It's making it worse, right? Instead of making it better. So I think that you guys have a really cool way of doing things that I wanted to make sure we had that chance to touch on.
Oh, absolutely. And I think those are the vendors we love to go in after to do an audit, because our audits are simple because they're free, right? There's nothing to lose. It's always found money. And there's never been an audit since 1989 where money has not been found. So you go in, that to us is low-hanging fruit, because I think a lot of people see the AI as a shiny new object that's out there, and it sounds cool, and it's going to solve a lot of problems, and it's going to fix a lot of things. And I think it will fix things, and I think it will cause a lot of problems that we don't even know are going to be problems. I go back to claims is very unique. And because of the uniqueness of claims, essentially, if we looked at 100 claims, you and I, they are all going to be different. Even things that seem exactly the same, a simple rear-end accident at a stop sign, there's even going to be complexities in that an AI tool might not be able to figure out, that a person will figure out by asking the right questions. And that's where you sit down, you build out your processes, you hire the right people, and you leverage the technology to gain some efficiencies, but you don't rely on the technology. You rely on the people and your processes first and foremost.
So that obviously has a big impact on identification. That's step one, right? So whenever I do trainings, I came up with this saying, no joke, a week ago, and I did a training for a carrier. And I call it the three Asians, right? It's identification, investigation, and then negotiation. And those are like the three legs of the stool in a way in the handling of claims. Now, investigation is the next one here. And similarly speaking, several vendors, law firms, claims adjusters, they need to be well-trained in how to investigate. AI and technology cannot investigate for you. It can help you get maybe police reports, help you get information, but it's never going to do the boots on the ground investigation. It's never going to look at Google Maps. Maybe it could one day and try to look and say, hey, what's the height of those stairs? Is there the stairs deteriorating? It's never going to go walk a scene and look and say, hey, is there a Ring security camera right there that had a photo or a video of the accident? It's never going to be able to go out there and really be the boots on the ground to take a look and work with experts to figure out if there is a fire. What caused the fire? Was it the dehumidifier? Was it the HVAC system? What was it? So there's a lot of these things that come into play that the people need to be involved in. We need good people. Now, investigation-wise, I have a couple stories that I always give. One of the top ones that reminds me how essential it is that we get out there to investigate was a case I handled a couple of years ago where a big chunk of plastic, right? All we know, big chunk of plastic comes frisbeeing through the air. goes through the window of a car driving down the highway. All right. Catastrophic injury. Sadly, the individual survived in a quadriplegic, vegetative state for a long time as well. Huge work comp claim. What happened is we immediately got involved, right? The carrier identified it. You know, they didn't wait 6 months, a year, like a lot of times happens. They immediately identified it, retained us, sent out in both of ONC, so a reconstructionist, and a private investigator. What we did is realized, yeah, probably a battery cap is what this looks would be from a commercial motor vehicle. We said we knew the trajectory, the direction the vehicle was going. So we sent that PI to stop at every gas station truck stop along the highway. An hour later, we get a call and say, hey, we got it. We found out that there's a truck that broke down exact time. They had a tire tread. We think that tire tread must have knocked off the battery cap. That was our thought. Perfect. With the police, we got the video. We identified the truck, went out there, and we're able to show that, yes, we saw that truck. Battery cap was missing in a joint inspection. They used a retread tire on the drive tire. There's also a defect that we litigated against the manufacturer of that battery cap. Huge recovery. Seven figures. Made this family, despite a bad situation, whole lower again, right? Brought 100% back to the comp carrier. And the only way we did that, if we waited 3 weeks, we probably would add nothing, right? If we waited 3 months, absolutely not. So these scenarios and stories tell me why like active subrogation is so important. And you can't investigate unless you identify, right? So being able to identify those claims and move quickly, that's huge. What do you think about investigation? What does your team do, or what do you train your people in to make sure that they're investigating these things properly?
So you have to ask the right questions, right? From a carrier perspective, I'm a big fan of boots on the ground, especially when you have large losses. You've got to get out there and you have to look for the clues before they disappear because evidence vanishes. And we ask carriers to do certain things. However, from a subrogation standpoint, we have a lot of adjusters that are, they're investigating, but they're investigating from a desk. So you have to have twofold. You have to have a combination of an external team, right? So we get a subrogation claim that comes in. We have to have someone go out and check out a scene. You've got to have an ecosystem put together that can do that. And I even tell carriers where they're highly specialized and everybody's sitting behind a desk, you still have to have that team, be it your staff or be it vendors, have the ability to go out, ask the questions, the who, what, when, where, how. You have to just be curious. And if something seems like it's wrong, it probably is. And so with claims, speed wins. You've got to basically be on these right away. The downside of a lot of carriers when they work with us is we get things after the fact. They get the loss in, they keep it with the adjuster works it, all of a sudden you're 90 days into this and hey, here's an assignment for you. Not all, we have some carriers that are right out of the gate, first notice of loss, we definitely are involved. And you find on those, you're going to have a higher win rate for sure. And it matters, comp claims matter because of the type of injuries that can happen. Property, unbelievable amounts of property subrogation is lost just because nobody went out and bothered with the evidence. It's long gone. We'll get this 90 days later. And it's like, all right, where's the dishwasher? Where's the piece of drywall? Where's the O-ring? Discarded. Had we been involved on day one, that subrogation would still exist. So to your point, yeah, the identification is huge. You got to be able to get those and score those immediately, be it a carrier working with a vendor, be it a carrier working with a law firm. You've got those first few hours are critical. And that really is the catalyst for the ensuing investigation so that you can gather up the evidence and build your case.
Absolutely. And another thing to note on that is one thing that when the frontline adjusters, when the team identifying those claims, the one thing we try to train them always not to do is ever to assess liability or viability. If there's any argument, we want that red flagged. Frankly, I've trained a few clients and it works really well that every matter is flagged for subrogation and they have to uncheck the box rather than check the box. There are some inefficiencies to that process. We haven't seen it as perfect, but they identify a significant amount more. But it's really about always thinking subrogation, even if you're not having baseline being, hey, everything has subro until it doesn't. That should still be the mindset, right? When we're looking at these things, we assume there's subro. If there's a third party involved at all, there's possible subro. And really, it's when they start assessing those things, because we've found a ton where no investigation, they looked at it, they made a value judgment. Next thing you know, it's found on a second look, a second review. And then, oh no, lo and behold, that dishwasher's gone. Nothing's there. And then they want us to make magic happen. Now, I can say that doesn't mean shut it down. Sometimes we can make magic happen. I often tell my audience, and when I train my attorneys and claims specialists, adjusters on subrogation, I often say, hey, here's the deal. I'm really proud of the cases I've tried and won. I've had some really cool ones, but I think I'm most proud, not of those cases, but more so of the ones where I had a really weak, terrible argument. I should have gotten nothing, but I ended up getting 50%. Those are the huge wins. And that's a mindset that's very different. And one thing, when I do my negotiations training, which is probably my favorite thing to speak about, I speak on negotiations at least once a week for clients. One of the first ones I talk about is think like a plaintiff's attorney. You know, subrogation is plaintiff's work. And that's really hard to hear from a lot in the insurance industry, largely because it's really defense myopic, right? A lot of us started on the liability end. A lot of subro attorneys were defense attorneys beforehand. Subro is starting to get cool, right? So it's one of those things where it used to be down in the basement behind the water heaters. Now you got a good prime floor. People care. It's tax-free money coming back in. But what that means, though, is that a lot of times there are those opportunities being missed because really we're not giving it that that attention it deserves. We just need to focus in on subro. You agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. I think back to my carrier days. One of the things that we did, because we recognized we had issues. We had the second look group come in and do a closed file on it. And they found us like millions of dollars that were missed. But we figured out that our adjusters were really busy and they just didn't have time for this stuff. And we put in a process where adjusters just stopped assessing, identifying subro. Everything went to subrogation, 100% of stuff. I don't care if it's a basic rear end accident, subro got to make the call on that. So you push that stuff out the door, send it to people that have that way of thinking. Because you're right, it is a different way of thinking. You put on your plaintiff's cap. You're looking for how am I going to get money back? And we did that. And we identified areas where adjusters were really not performing well in certain aspects of their job. Certain aspects, they did a great job. You want to really focus them in on that. Pull the stuff where there's challenges. So miss subro, send all the claims over to subro, let them make a determination. Inbound subrogation demands from other carriers. They'd sit on an adjuster's desk for months. You'd have this ridiculous default after default from ARB forums. Pull those out, give them to subro, let a group of people work those. And that way, what happened was adjusters liked it because they didn't like this stuff to begin with. And guess what? Their production numbers went up. And the subro people got more claims, and you pay them a percentage of what they're winning on. All of a sudden, they like this because they're finding more stuff. So subro results go up, your win rates go up, your production numbers go up. It's all about tweaking the process and allowing people to do what they're really good at.
Now, along the same lines, one thing I'd love to hear more from you about is something that seems pretty self-serving whenever I speak on it. It's the idea of retaining and bringing in legal counsel for subrogation matters. I want to bring it up because I know your team does a really good job with this, as do most of our clients that our firm work with who are in the TPA or subro vendor space. But there's a lot of vendors out there who there's an inherent kind of conflict there in some situations where the vendor benefits from never bringing counsel in, but the client benefits from bringing counsel in more often. It's about finding that sweet spot. Most of the good vendors, they don't care about it, but they care about the conflicts. Like, we don't care about just making the most money in every individual claim. We care about bringing the most money in for the carrier, which I know your team does. How do we assess claims, and how do you currently still assess claims with your team to realize, you know what, it's time to bring counsel in. Enough with the demand letters. We're not getting it resolved. It's time to bring in the kind of the sharp sword of subrogation, hopefully MWL, and litigate those cases.
Oh, absolutely. There's a couple things that happen out in the industry. One is you've got some really good firms, right? So you guys are a great example. There's probably not a firm on earth that knows more about subrogation than MWL. In fact, I think I have a library full of Gary's books. But there comes a time when you throw your hands up, but it shouldn't take you that long. You handle enough claims, you know when things are not going to resolve. You know what carriers are going to be difficult. You know what jurisdictions are going to be difficult. Individual adjusters that are going to be difficult. And at some point, you have to just have, again, back to your processes. What things have to happen on your punch list to get it to an attorney? And it shouldn't be waiting till the last minute. It should be part of the process. And you should have your panel set up, your specialty set up. And it, as an adjuster, you're going through, this is what I need to do. And, I've come to this impasse, time to refer it out. And then don't dilly-dally on that. Get it out the door and then let attorneys work on it. Because again, let's say we've sent out three letters and it's taken us, we're 90 days into this thing, 120 days into this thing. We know we've dealt with this carrier before. We've dealt with this adjuster before. We know this is never going to settle. And here's why, because this is the game that they play. Don't send out 6 months worth of letters. Don't let that thing sit there. Get it to counsel, let them work it. And sometimes all it takes is a letter from the attorney to make things happen all of a sudden. My point is it's a partnership and you should never go in this being self-serving. To your point, it is all about the client. The client hires us for a reason. Part of that reason is us, our reputation, our results. Part of that is the ecosystem that we've put in place. Who are the investigators that we use? Who are the attorneys that we use? So you want to take advantage of that. And money comes in the door a lot faster that way. And that's a win-win for everybody.
Absolutely. And I think that's it's a big thing in the industry, especially for workers' compensation subrogation. We're training on this all the time. And we look, and I get calls probably, I'd say sadly, three times a week, where carrier reaches out and says, hey, or vendor reaches out and says, hey, Ashton, we have this case, plaintiff's counsel in California. They just got with the defense attorney day before trial and settled around us. We have a $200,000 lien. What do we do? And my answer is, did you intervene? No, we didn't. We wanted to hold it. Like, we didn't want to spend the money on the fees. Guess what? You get $0 now. So I think that's a big factor. It's about your team does a good job. And it's about telling the industry, like, we need to find the right way to build these big and substantial partnerships between carrier, self-insured, sub-revender, law firm, so that we all work together to do what's best for the claim, to bring in the most possible money. Because you mentioned a few times, subrogation claims, they do not age like wine, they age like milk. I've never seen one subrogation case that got better with time. Evidence deteriorates, witnesses' memories aren't as fresh. There's a lot of benefits to quick action, which involves quick identification, immediate investigation, as quick as possible negotiations, the three Asians.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you've got to have it's no different than preparing for a football game. You've got to have a plan. Every claim that comes in the door, you've got to have a game plan. And sometimes it's going to be a similar game plan. Sometimes it's going to be different. And again, it depends on the type of claim coming in the door. To your point, work comp claims, there's a lot of nuances to those. There's a lot of challenges. You got 50 states that have 50 different laws that are all over the board. Not everybody's cut out to handle those. That's why you have dedicated teams inside like our organization. You guys are very well suited in all fronts, but in particular, we've had great luck on the work comp front. And not everybody takes that approach. And that's bad for really everybody involved throughout the whole ecosystem.
Now, before we wrap things up, Chris, I want to talk a bit about industry trends we're seeing. Because I think that we both see different things, but we probably see similar things. Industry trends on your end, I think, are going to be how claims are being handled, what carriers can do better. On our end, it's obviously we're active in the Kia Hyundai litigation. We have a lot of claims against range and stove manufacturers for inadvertent ignition claims. We're always seeing different things. We all work closely together as we identify things to put them into pursuit. What trends are you seeing? What are you seeing in the industry? Where do you think things are going?
So I would say that we identify the trends most often through our closed file audits, right? So we're going in, that's a retrospective look. And in an industry that needs to be more forward thinking, you hate to do the retrospective, be reactionary, but that's where you see things. And we continue to see a lot of mis-subrogation. It varies by carrier, but I'm going to say on average, we just did an audit. 21% of the files we looked at, mis-subrogation. Another one, it was close to 30%. Another one, it was about 6%. So it does vary, but that's a challenge. And I think that comes back to basic training. So I think the number one trend is there really is a lot of inconsistency. There is not a huge amount of training. Not every carrier. There's some carriers that put on very good training programs, but we do see a lot of inconsistency. There's not a lot of calibration in organizations. And this is something that I really push for. So when I'm out doing my little dog and pony show, I do a whole section on calibration. It should be, if I give the same claim to 100 adjusters, I shouldn't get 100 different outcomes. I should get 100 outcomes that are pretty well aligned. That would be the sign of a calibrated organization. We're seeing some crazy things too. I've got one. I'll share it with you. I won't name any names, but we've got a carrier that is getting inundated with demands from a certain rental car company. And I don't know that this is an industry trend. It's certainly a trend for this particular carrier. But essentially what's happening is insureds are going out, they're renting vehicles, and they're not taking out the collision damage waiver because they've got their own insurance. And then this rental car company is coming in and they're basically saying, you're going to pay me 100% of what I want. Oh, sorry, I don't have any documentation. I don't have an estimate. I don't have photographs. I'm not going to show you any proof that our fleet was maxed out. So I'm entitled to all my loss of use and my administrative fees. And oh, by the way, if you don't pay me what I want, I'm going after your insured, which is pretty significant. In fact, this particular carrier shared with me that this rental car company signed a release and then proceeded to go after the insured after the release was signed. Things like that come up that are concerning, right? So you have the things that are potentially controllable and trainable, like improved training, driving calibration in your organization. And then you have kind of these out of the blue things that come up. And I'm using rental cars, but we see other facets of claims as well that pop up, maybe not as a trend, but against a particular carrier for whatever reason.
Yeah. And one of the trends that I think would be remiss if we didn't touch on. So I'm always thinking, where's the future going to be? And I'm speaking in NASP, but I just did a podcast recording on this thing. I've done two of them on autonomous vehicle technology. And that's one thing that I think that I know you have on your radar. I have definitely on my radar. And it's the idea that more and more often, I'm seeing about 20% of auto claims, right? Where we get them to litigate, where there's some sort of allegation that there's some sort of defect with the manufacturer, with newer vehicles, be it even something as simple as the adaptive cruise control failed or lane assist. I don't have any fancy AI autonomous technology in my vehicle. I have lane assist and I can't tell you how many times I'm driving on the highway and it just curves me to the side, pulls me to the side. We're seeing more and more. And one thing in the industry is if you are listening and you are an auto adjuster, auto claim supervisor, attorney handling primarily auto claims, this is the time that you're going to have to really start learning product liability rules. Our firm has a full product liability vertical, probably one of the most extensive product liability litigation teams in the country. And I can tell you that they're seeing these things and the carriers, they're going to have to start finding a way to either one, train their auto adjusters or two, develop partnerships with if they have a homeowners team, with their team handling products claims. And what does that mean? That's going to mean in the near future, that adjuster that could handle 400 auto claims, they're probably going to be able to handle half that because there's going to be necessary inspections, duties to preserve evidence, working with experts to do joint scenes, joint labs to figure out exactly what sensor failed, what occurred. Was this an issue with the software or with the actual physical hardware? Lots of things going on there. And that's one thing I would encourage everybody who's interested in subrogation, who handles auto claims, start focusing in on that because you're going to be so far ahead of your contemporaries that it's going to really distinguish yourself in your career.
Yeah, and you bring up a good point because I think that as you look across trends in the industries, and going a little bit outside of subrogation, but down the road of, say, third-party litigation funding, which is becoming a big issue, you're seeing, I think one of the biggest trends I'm seeing is the plaintiff attorneys are light years ahead of where the carriers are. So as we're sitting here doing a podcast today, as we go to conferences and we'll see each other a few times over the next few months, trial lawyers are doing the same thing. And they've really honed in on leveraging the AI for things like demand generation. They've really improved their processes. I've called a couple of plaintiff firms just to go through the intake process, not to really file a claim, but to understand what they're doing on their end. And it's a world of difference than calling into, say, a first notice of loss. And I think that there's a lot that, even though they are our adversaries much of the time, there's a lot that we can learn from them to maybe trend in a more positive direction.
Yeah, we don't have to start from scratch, right? That's what I tell everybody when I do these trainings. We talk about, hey, you don't have to know everything. Look for resources. Look out there. Ask others what they're doing. Ask your competitors. Look online. We have the most trafficked legal website in the world for a reason. It's all of our charts, all of our resources.
Right.
See what's already pre-existing, because you don't have to recreate the wheel on things. Best practices and procedures, SOPs, all of that doesn't have to be homegrown. We should find the best things we can do for Henley claims, and we should implement those things. It doesn't have to be your idea. Even if it's somebody else's idea, you implemented internally, it's now your idea.
Yeah. And you brought this up, you brought up something very early in the podcast, but it's really on the carriers networking better together. So bringing like positioned individuals, say CEOs, chief claims officers, creating work groups where they can leverage one another, right? So we have got a relationship, and we have for a number of years. And if I have an issue, I'll call you up. Hey, Ashton, we've got this challenge. What would you recommend? So having like-minded folks from different companies being able to do that. And we know the plaintiffs do this, and they really don't seem to have any of the regulatory challenges that insurers may have with anti-steering and things like that. But I do think that there is a big opportunity to bring folks like that together so that they can really focus on best practices. Because when you have an industry that has a really good set of best practices and they're really organized, they're streamlined, they've got great processes in place, they're calibrated, the people that benefit are the consumers, it's the businesses, and it's even people like you and I. Because when we get an assignment, it's going to be a much better put together. You're going to have a good, solid investigation, and your negotiations are going to be solid and understood and well documented. Creating that rather than a calibrated organization, having a calibrated industry, I think is good for all involved.
100%. I know we're coming up on about an hour with everybody, so I think we need to wrap this thing up so that our audience, this is fascinating stuff. So everyone is enthralled, fascinated. Hopefully no one's fallen asleep, but one thing I want to say is before we wrap this thing up, let's do a final plug of both of our podcasts. Chris, for my audience, tell me where we can find you, find your podcast, so that everyone can listen to you on their commute to the office.
So The Claim Hunters is available on really any podcast platform. So you can go to Apple, you can go to Captivate, iHeart, you can go to SubroIQ.com and hit the podcast button. The other thing I will say is you have all got a lot of really good listeners. Love to have any of them as a guest, and they can reach out to me, Chris Tidball, on LinkedIn, or they can go to the SubroIQ.com website and hit the podcast button. But love to sign some people up to share their story.
Absolutely. And then for your audience, we have the Subrogation Support Network podcast, similar to you, available wherever podcasts are listened to, Spotify, Apple Podcasts. On our firm website, mwl-law.com. If you haven't used our website before, I encourage everyone in the audience, most of you, I'd say 9 out of 10 insurance people I talk to, whether they realize it or not, have one of my charts bookmarked on their desktop. But take a look, because if you're not using them, you're wasting a lot of time, be it statute of limitations, seatbelt laws in all 50 states. We have all these surveys. Check it out. And then if you need to reach me for anything, it's A. Kirsch, that's AKIRSCH at MWL-law.com. Chris, man, it's been a pleasure. I always love seeing you. It's always a good time to talk to you. I'll see you. See you NASP this year.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I trust you're going to be coming on our expedition with us. I can send you more information on that.
You let me know. I'm always down for a good expedition. No question.
That sounds good. All right. Thank you for having me.
All right, everyone. Thank you so much. Again, your host, Ashton Kirsch, and my co-host today, Chris Titball, signing off with the Subrogation Support Network and Claims Hunters Podcast. Until next time.
Thank you for joining the Claim Hunters. We hope you enjoyed our show. If you would like to share your story, head on over to subroiq.com and click the YouTube button.